You're listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, hosted and created by me, Imani, a researcher. This is the podcast for people who research people. In today's episode, I'll be speaking with Andrea Stella.
So my name is Andrea Stella. I am currently the principal UX researcher at Henry Schein One, and I previously was working at Sony Music Entertainment as their lead UX researcher. And then before that, I was in academia for most of my life in different research and academic kind of capacities.
Andrea will be talking about her path from academia to her current career as a user experience researcher in industry. And so you currently work in the private sector, but before that, you mentioned you worked in academia. What were you doing in academia?
So I was a few things. I was a student. I was in a PhD program that was focused on composition and rhetoric. So I was in the English department. And I was also a professor for about 7 years, teaching first year writing composition. And then for the kind of the longest period, I was doing research as well, both as a graduate fellow and as a person in the nonprofit sector. So a lot of what is now called user experience research, I was doing a long time before it was called that.
Yeah, that's a theme in a lot of these interviews I do, is that people were already doing UX research oftentimes for years and didn't know it had a name. and that it was a separate thing. But you did figure that out. What moment made you consider working in industry?
So I had spent so much time in academia, and in the PhD program, I kind of had these rose-colored glasses of thinking that, okay, great, I'll do this. And I know the job market's horrible, but at some point I'll end up with a tenured position and then, you know, it'll be smooth sailing. And then I guess it was about more than halfway into the program is when I realized that there weren't really any tenured jobs. And then the ones that existed were very low paying. And so it was a low paying job, but also if I wanted to be competitive, I would have to move to somewhere that was not my home, because my home is New York City. So I was not willing to do any of those things. And that is when I started to consider looking elsewhere. And also I had had a really rough semester or two with the fellowship that I was working in, where they were really trying to, I guess, I don't know, they wouldn't call it hazing, but they were trying to show me what it was like to be in academia and to be a faculty member. And I was like, wait, this is the worst middle school kind of situation that I absolutely don't want to spend my time in. So that was when I realized, I think it's time for me to head out.
The market for academics always seems to be, for tenure track academics always seems to be bad. I remember when I was in college, like a long time ago, I had briefly considered getting a PhD. Every professor I spoke to said, no, don't do that. You don't want to do that. You describe all the same stuff you described, the hazing, the publisher perish, the lack of job market for PhDs, low pay, bullying. But you also had mentioned offline that you spoke with someone in your program who was in industry, who was doing curriculum building. How did that conversation help you figure out how to find jobs on LinkedIn?
Yes. So that was exactly the trajectory. I felt desperate, definitely, when I realized that I was going to start the process of leaving academia. And I also should note that on the side of academia, since academia doesn't pay even with a fully funded fellowship, I was also working in the hospitality industry. So I had multiple jobs, and I kind of had to take a moment to consider how I would pivot away from both and still be able to survive. So I talked to one of my friends who was in my PhD program. She sent me over, she just kind of serendipitously forwarded me a job posting from somebody who had previously been in our program. And I didn't fit that job description, but I wanted to speak to this person who had been in the program earlier than me, and to kind of hear from her and how she had made the move into industry. So we talked for half an hour, and the first thing that she said was, you're going to hate it, but you have to get on LinkedIn. And it's funny because in academia, almost no academics have LinkedIn profiles, accounts, or anything. And so I very begrudgingly kind of set it up. And then I decided to start to do a gut check as I was going through these LinkedIn different jobs and different opportunities and looking at people's profiles, because what she was doing in industry, I actually realized I really wasn't interested in at all. And I wanted to make sure that if I was going to make this leap, that I wasn't just jumping into another bad situation.
And LinkedIn is such a valuable tool when you don't have an established network in a certain industry or in a certain career path, because how would you know which job to pick first? And how would you know what career pathing looks like if not for something like LinkedIn? So yeah, and also, yeah, a lot of academics don't use LinkedIn.
Right. And I mean, I very, you know, I would give this advice to anybody, or I have given this advice to that. I quite literally went through job descriptions. And then I also went through and looked at people who are in these roles and just sat after reading the job description. I would sit with it for a minute or less and just feel how it was in my body. And if I felt like I wanted to run away, that's where I was like, okay, let me not do that. And so that's how I ended up finding UX research as the path, because every time I was reading either somebody who is in UX research, what it was that they were doing, or the job descriptions, I kind of got this kind of like a light bulb moment, or I was finding where I was like, oh, I want to find out more about this. And so it was very much just kind of feeling it out. So I knew I didn't want to be a curriculum builder or doing anything like that.
Yeah, your intuition is a really important part of life and also in helping you figure out what to do in the next step in your career. I think when it comes to something, I guess, professional, like your job, people disregard their intuition and their hunches and that gut feeling. But that's how you figure out life, is that gut feeling. But I like that was an important part of your career path.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it sort of had to be, because I didn't have anything else to, I didn't have any other reference point. And so what's funny is that now that I've started to claim this identity as a researcher, it makes sense that that's exactly what I wanted to do, is I wanted to find as many data points as I could. And so one of them was absolutely intuition, felt sense, what was available in the market. At the time when I was applying, it was actually in the beginning of the downturn, but there were still positions that were available. And so it was just kind of seeing what's possible.
And how did you make the pivot from academia to industry?
Oh, I mean, I found you first. So basically what happened was I started doing kind of an audit of my work experience, but I did that because I started looking for coaches. I started looking for people. I was like, I can't do this on my own. Especially when I was looking at just even the beginning of the LinkedIn situation, an academic CV is so different from a resume, from a industry CV, and also from LinkedIn, that I was like, I don't even know where to begin. So I started looking for people, and I found you. I actually found the podcast. I was like, oh, this feels like it's approachable. And then the steps that you laid out in order to even just apply to your program really got me starting to think in industry terms, in ways that I could market myself as a UX researcher. And so that is how I got myself ready, essentially.
We worked a lot on language, right? Like translating like academic speak into industry speak. That was a big part of our time working together, because it is hard. Like when you have a CV, an academic CV, it's long. You have all the conferences you've presented at. It doesn't matter when you're getting hired as a UX researcher, your publications, that doesn't really matter as much when you're being hired as a UX researcher, your experience, your skills, your portfolio, yeah, and how you talk about yourself, because you already had the experience. Like the bulk of your academic research was, like you said, UX research, and you did things like case studies, interviews, and I believe you did some clinical research as well. You did a lot of stuff that felt very UX-y, but it was just kind of hard initially making that translation. So we worked together a lot on that. And that definitely helped you obviously make a very successful pivot.
Yes.
And when you were pivoting from academia to industry, what was hard about the pivot?
Oh, I would say that the language probably was the most challenging, that and imposter syndrome that I still deal with, even as a principal UX researcher. I think that there are definitely differences between academia and industry. There's differences in the cadence, the way that projects move, and the way that people kind of think through things. In academia, it's both a blessing and a curse that things take forever. And so you can really, like, I was very used to sitting with a problem for maybe years and just kind of peeling it back into every single layer that I could possibly get to. Whereas in industry, it was starting to learn how to just kind of accept that there is a point of good enough, that, okay, we've found enough people to talk to be able to satisfy us for this. And it wasn't with the same kind of rigor, obviously, as a clinical trial or something like that, where we had to be so meticulous and make sure we had enormous sample sizes and all these things. And now I find myself saying sometimes, like, okay, well, you know, are we happy with 15 people? Is that enough for us to make a design decision? And so it's sort of, I think that's been one of the hardest parts, is letting go of some of that rigor, some of that research rigor that was, instilled in me for decades.
I believe that for UX researchers, we definitely do use a scientific method, but I always say it's more of a looser, more forgiving understanding of a scientific method. Like you said, it's quicker pace. You don't spend as much time with the research usually. Yeah, so I definitely, that was probably something for me when I had my first UX researcher job, I thought the same thing. I was used to thinking in more academic terms. Okay, I have to move a little bit faster in industry.
Yeah, exactly.
And so conversely, what was easy about the pivot from academia to industry?
I think it took me a good 6 months to feel comfortable in my first role, because it was the first time that I was working with different people in different job titles. But once I was able to kind of crack that code of, this is a product manager, oh, I've worked with somebody similar to this in a different capacity. Once I was able to sort of see where the roles in industry overlaid with the experiences that I had in academia, that's when I started to feel a lot more confident in my research experience, that even though I hadn't come from industry, I didn't do a boot camp, there are still some tools that I haven't used, but that my core understanding of research is really refined. And that is, I think I would say, where, not to say that it's gotten easy, but where I've started to feel more confidence. I'm like, oh no, I if there's one thing I know how to do, it is research.
Yeah, at the core, I feel like any researcher who isn't a UX researcher can pivot into UX research with the right refinement and focus, because at your core, you still are a researcher. To an extent, we all follow the scientific method, some more closely than others. But I feel like at the core, any researcher can probably do UX research because it's research and we get research.
Exactly.
What are some differences for you between conducting research in academia as opposed to conducting it in a corporate or industry setting?
So academia, I think things do take so long, but by the time you get to the point of doing research, everything is so, what's the word that I'm looking for? It's so focused. And by that point, people have been screened, they've been vetted, we know exactly what it is that we're looking for. And it's very specific. And what I'm finding more in industry, actually what I've found now in the two roles that I have been in within industry, is that I'm coming into spaces where products were built and over decades, there were, you know, obviously work was happening, but research didn't exist. And so now what I'm finding is that there's a lot of kind of reverse engineering of understanding what it is that the user is experiencing, what it is that the user needs. And so that, I would say, is a very big difference. Because in academia, you can't go forward, or in clinical and health research, you can't go forward until the research has happened. Whereas this is saying, it's like, okay, well, now we already did the thing. So let's make sure now, and kind of go back and check and double check our work and now change from there. So it's been, it's, I feel like it's the place that I'm entering into the conversations is different than where it was in academia.
That's a good point. I never thought about that, especially in clinical research. You have to do your research ahead of time, because if you're researching, let's say, a drug, you can't just put that out.
You can't just go out on the market, right?
Right?
But, like, most certainly not.
Right. But if you're creating an app or some other web-based product, it can go out without being tested, and you just sometimes you'll test it after it's already out. Right?
Exactly. And that's where I've landed, is mostly in these products where it's, you know, we needed to get it out. And it's like, okay, let's see now that it's out, how it's going.
Exactly. And that is a big difference to think about in terms of doing research, and also the positioning of research, how you do it, what questions you ask, who's involved, and the stakes. Obviously, the stakes are probably, I would assume, a lot higher in a clinical research study than it is in, like, a UX research study. Yeah. So you probably feel less pressure too as a UX researcher that it's okay if something isn't correct. The best products are built by listening to your customers. But without a great tool, capturing quality insights is nearly impossible. DScout was built to solve this challenge. Whether you're running moderated or unmoderated research, the DScout platform helps you recruit high-quality participants, manage unlimited concurrent studies, and share insights and video clips in minutes. Stop overpaying for questionable research. Instead, partner with DScout, the company trusted by Spotify, Lululemon, Google, and more. Visit dscout.com for all the tools you need to boost your insights program.
Absolutely. I do. But at the same time, I think that what I've found is I've been really lucky to be at organizations where product managers, product owners, designers have wanted to take on research because they do want to hear from the users. But what I have found is that even though the stakes are much lower, I am still concerned with kind of like the do no harm of research. So I had a recent study with a PM who was leading it, and it just kind of, and I just wanted to see, I started a new role and I was, you know, okay, how is this going to go? And the PM kind of just went all over the place, and it was a very long interview. And then at the end, I was like, I don't think that we're even able to solution towards any of these things that we were asking this person. And so for me, I think I'm still holding at the standard of, hey, let's try to make smaller research decisions so that if we're asking for somebody's time, we're not asking it into the void, and that they're just giving us all these wishes and they're offering us all these pain points and we can't actually do anything with them. Because that for me still feels as icky as not being able to provide somebody something on a clinical side. You know, just there's something in there that I think maybe that's just in me, I don't know, or maybe that happens with every researcher.
And that's to be expected too. Like, when you're working with stakeholders who aren't researchers, like PMs, most PMs don't have a background in research, hence why they have the researchers there. Exactly. Like, research is really hard. And I think that sometimes, because we are researchers, we overestimate how hard it can be. Asking the right questions, getting the right audience. When you get your person, your respondent in front of you, what if they're not answering? How do you pull those answers out of them? I think that's really hard for experienced researchers. For people who don't have a formal background in research, I can imagine it's even more difficult. And it feels like sometimes you're just throwing things at the wall just to see what sticks. But in reality, it can be more organized. But it is hard to get there, even as a researcher. Yeah, so I can empathize with that PM. So are there, when we're talking about your transition from academia to industry, are there any specific skills or methodologies from academia that you find useful in your current role?
So it's funny. I was gonna actually, I will say that I had to spend a lot of time writing, obviously, in academia and publishing and doing all of that. And so what I've actually done in industry is, since there is no expectation of writing a 35-page journal article, I have been kind of hitting the ground with that and really taking my time to do these smaller kind of like snippets of documentation And I've really been trying to make sure that that is sort of my legacy, because it was really, really hard for me to write when I was in academia. And it's such a laborious, enormous process. And so now I'm like, okay, if there's a gift that I can give to myself now that I'm in industry, let me take all of that, the process or the lack thereof. And I think more just even the time grappling with the writing and the reading and all of that, let me focus it now instead on something that's really specific, really tight. And now I can have these one pagers or really small decks that end up seeming very impressive to the people that I'm providing them to, that are my research outcomes. But it's a really tight distillation of research methodology in a way that doesn't really exist in academia. And so that's, I think, the gift I've given myself from academia.
So much writing and no pressure. And now in industry, there's no pressure. There's no publish or perish, right? You're like, you don't have to publish anything. It's nice.
No, well, people want even less. They're like, can you get this to me in less? I'm like, it was only 5 sentences. They're like, okay, but can you get it to me in one? And I'm like, what? So it's, you know, it's like, okay, if you want the least amount of text, how can I get us there? It's doing the inverse of what I was used to. But I think that that's been to a real benefit, and it's been playful, actually. It's been fun to try on this new way of delivering the message, delivering the information.
Yeah, make it shorter. What did you accomplish in your first 90 days as a UX researcher at your first UX research gig?
I dove right in. At both, actually, but at the first one, I was brought on specifically because they were in the middle of a project that was really important to kind of understanding the foundation of the user base for two newly merged organizations, and they didn't have a researcher specifically looking at it, so they tossed me in pretty much day one. They were like, this is what we need you to do. And then in tandem, as it unfolded, I was able to start to build the research practice. But really, I had to hit the ground running and start interviewing people almost immediately, picking up on research that some of the designers had been trying to pull together. And so I think that was sort of the first lesson in industry, was just be prepared to dive in and for it not to be perfect. And for you, you're kind of like... you're on the ship that's already sailing, or they like take the buoy and bring you to the side and toss you in type thing and then keep going.
Do you remember what that felt like? Like, I remember having like my first UX researcher role and being excited but overwhelmed, even though I had done some flavor of this work before. It's like, wow, I messed around and I got this UX researcher job, and now I have to actually do it. Right? Did you feel that?
Oh my God, yes. I mean, I still feel it, you know, in different ways, because there are so many different kind of avenues that people can enter into UX research. And I think that UX research looks so many different ways. So definitely in my first 90 days, I was questioning myself a ton. I had no idea how to go from interviewing people in academia to interviewing people in industry. It turns out it's pretty much identical. I mean, still people, and it's still asking questions. But I was just trying to really get my footing. And, you know, not dissimilar to academia, there's also not, I found that people were actually more generous in industry to support and to help me than they were in academia. But once I was in the role, it was, everybody kept saying to me like, okay, well, you're the researcher. We're so excited to have you. And I was like, me? Like, I'm the researcher? So that was the thing that was, and you know, and it still happens today. They're like, oh, this is great. We finally have you. I'm like, you people are overselling me. Like, I don't know. But apparently, you know, we know what we're doing on some level. So I think it was like the first 90 days was realizing like, oh, I am the researcher. Okay. Like, I got this.
And you're the principal researcher now. So that's like a very high level.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was for me. So when I had first started my first UX researcher role years ago, that's when I learned about imposter syndrome, because I was feeling that. I'm like, they would ask me, oh, is this a sound research study if people were doing research on their own? I'm thinking to myself, well, is it? I mean, I would give them a nice confident answer, but I'm thinking to myself, is it? yeah, when I would do my own studies, I'm like, okay, how will they feel about the findings? If they ask me questions about the findings, which is perfectly normal and healthy, I would think, okay, well, did I mess this up? Like the imposter syndrome was just heavy.
I still get that too, where I think that's the thing that's interesting, at least for the way my UX research experience has gone. I'm not sure if the same is for you, but I have really been holding on to the fact that I am an expert at the act of researching, but I will never be the expert of a PM's product. So I need them to, so I might be able to support with the research and help them with the findings and do some help them synthesize, you know, what we find, but ultimately they are the ones who are really going to be the expert at the product. And so that's a little bit, that's been challenging too, because it's been both challenging and I think a little bit freeing, because I feel like I can kind of say, okay, here is as far as I can bring you with this. Now you need to go the rest of the way. I think in the beginning I was trying to solution for the product managers or for the designers. And then I realized like, oh, I don't have to. That's actually not my role. I am absolutely not a designer. I will not know how to get this done. So it was nice to be able to have that really segmented. And that's where I think also I was able to feel more confident in, I am the researcher. I will do the research. And I very clearly say no to other things that I do not do because I can't do them.
Exactly. And that made me think about something. That's a red flag for me in interviews for UX researcher roles. When I've had interviewers ask me, how would you translate your findings into the product? I'm thinking to myself, I'm not the PM. I'm not the designer. Exactly. I'm not the head of engineering, right? Like I can collaborate with them to figure out what could be viable from a research or customer facing perspective. But whenever I get asked that question or some variation of it in interviews, I'm like, this is a red flag because you're expecting me to do multiple things, but you're hiring me for one specific thing. So yeah, for people listening, that can be a red flag too, that job, they're probably hiring you to do more than what they're saying. So that you made me think about that. That was a good point.
Or if they ask you about your experience with Figma, let me tell you, that's been a red flag for me. Because I'm like, well, I have definitely used FigJam. I don't love it. I have other tools. But if you want me to use Figma, let me remind you, I am not a designer. So, exactly. And I have to own it, because that's the thing too, is that I know that there are people who have the capacity to toe the line between design and research. That is not me. I knew going into this that my experience was research, and that was what I could really lean on, but I absolutely know nothing about design. And I think even when you and I first started talking, I was considering looking into design, and I think we realized that it made more sense for me to specialize, because it does, because it's like, okay, no, this is the role. This is what I am capable of. And so, yes, if somebody asks me about Figma, that for me is the red flag of like, what do you think I can do? Because I can't do that.
I agree. Like, especially in this current job market, I guess it's a hiring market. So the employers temporarily are at an advantage, and they really take advantage of their advantage. And they're hiring they're hiring for jobs that are clearly labeled UX researcher. And then they'll spring on you in the interview, oh, hey, do you know how to use Figma? Or have you designed an actual prototype before? I'm just like, well, no, you didn't mention that on the job description. And I applied for a researcher role, not a designer. And a lot of companies combine them, which is fine, but they don't always make it clear that they want people who do both. It's very deceptive. That's a different conversation for a different day. But yes, I definitely relate to how deceptive a lot of the job descriptions can be. And in terms of your professional development, so now you are in your zone right now. You're working at the principal level. What types of professional development or training have you pursued since transitioning into UX research, and how have they impacted you?
So I am involved. I love the listserv. That's actually how I found this most recent role. The design, what is it? Design research something. One of the listservs. I love one of the listservs because I can watch and see sort of what's going on, the questions that people are asking, what's happening in the industry, what people are thinking about. And then I've actually, the way that I've started to do training is through the vendors. When I was at my first role, we switched from one surveying tool to another. And so in that process of doing that switch and that conversion, I was really able to sort of understand and learn a lot more about the surveying tools, their capabilities, what to do with them, what not to do with them, how to best kind of optimize that, how to start to put together a research repository. And then I've just been, honestly, there's a lot of good people on LinkedIn too. And I look at people who are posting things for different Notion templates, thinking through how they're using them, editing them myself, practicing with them, trying them out, seeing how my team likes them, if they like them. Unfortunately, in my first role, we did use Notion as an organization, and I got used to it and I really liked it. And now at this role, we absolutely do not have Notion at all. And so I'm trying to do that switch. But I think that a lot of my, the training has been more diving into the various tools that I didn't have access to in academia because there's no money, or at least they say there's no money. And so now I get to be a little bit more robust in learning about all of that.
Yeah. And also I work as a contractor. So every few months I'm working with a different company, and each company uses different tools. For the most part, these UX tools, they do more or less, they're not that different.
Right.
Yeah. They're not that different, but they still are different enough. I'm just like, well, yeah, it's going to take some time to learn how to use this one. Yeah. And getting used to that every few months. It is an adjustment. Like you said, it can be learned, but it is an adjustment. And lastly, so you gave a lot of good advice. Can you offer any more advice to academics considering a similar transition into UX research, especially in terms of relevant skills, of building a relevant skill set and finding jobs?
Well, the very first thing I would say is do it. Do it yesterday. Do it as soon as you can. Run from academia. No, and you know, it's I had a very long, long tenure with academia. So this is, you know, that's my own thing. But I would say to do an audit of all of the experience that you have had before you do anything. Don't start a boot camp. Don't try to do, you know, and don't do paid courses or anything like that before you have really sat down and looked through what your experiences have been and have potentially done that with a professional coach. I couldn't recommend it more, especially because if you've been in academia, even for a master's, you have spent a significant amount of time doing very, very rigorous work. And so if there's ways to translate that will be able to benefit you getting into industry instead of following down what I was going to do. I was ready to go to one of the camps and do that because I really thought that I needed it. And it's not that I don't think that there are good tools to come from it, but I just think that if you've spent time in academia, especially at the higher levels, you've put in your time. So now just figure out ways to translate that and connect with as many people as you can who have made the leap. Definitely.
Academic experience is experience. I don't have a PhD, but I got my start in research as an undergrad, as a research assistant. When I was looking for my first full-time job, I was putting my undergrad research that I had done for what, 3 or 4 years, most if not all of my time in school as experience, because it was to me.
It is.
I remember hiring manager saying that, oh, well, this is stuff you did in school. I'm like, well, it still is experience. I learned how to do this research that you were attracted to because of the schoolwork, because of this work I did in school. But some hiring managers misinterpret academic experience as not real experience, but it is. So I'm happy that you mentioned that if you are an academic, whether at the graduate level or an undergrad looking for your first researcher role, your experience as an undergraduate research assistant, as a PhD, that does count, and it is research experience. So I'm happy that you mentioned that people shouldn't be discouraged because some hiring managers disregard their experience.
I was able to translate all of my research experience into industry terms. And it wasn't disingenuous, it was real experience. It was just that in order for somebody in industry to really understand what it was that I had done, I needed to put it in their language. And so I did.
Yeah, and I helped you with that, the translation.
Yes, you did.
A little shameless plug there. Okay, well, did you have anything else? That was the last question I had. Did you have anything else you wanted to share that we didn't discuss that you wanted to mention for someone who's trying to make that transition or that leap?
Take at least a month, I would say, to really sit with all of the different opportunities, because I chose UX research because at the end of the day, I realized that what I am at my core is a researcher, but there are a lot of different academic or like post-academic avenues, and just make sure that you are moving into the right one. Actually, that's a good reminder that the person that I had spoken to with very back at the beginning that we were talking about, who was doing the curriculum building, she said to me that if she had taken more time with her beginning search, she probably would not have been in the role and industry that she is in. Now she is in this role, she has moved into different positions, but she's still within that niche. And I think that there are parts of it that she likes, but I don't think it is where she would have chosen had she taken a little bit of time to think about it. Whereas for me, I'm like, this is it. This is my career. This is where I will stay. I'm happy here. And I mean, I do feel lucky for that, but definitely I would just say, take the time.
How do you take that time when you have other priorities? Like obviously you have your kids, you have to look out for them. You have life happening outside of the job search. How do you stay grounded and focused when you're taking that time to be introspective? Especially at a time like this where the economy for a lot of industries is very shaky. Temporarily, we're going to make a comeback, but right now it's shaky. How do people stay grounded? How did you stay grounded doing that introspection?
That's a really good question, because mind you, I was doing this introspection and leaving academia while I had a full-time job in hospitality. Full-time job in hospitality. So, and two toddlers. So no, I did not have time to luxuriate in a month. But what I did do is that when I had 15 minutes in the morning, I would commit to, because basically what I did was I set the commitment. It was the beginning of September. And I said, you know, I can't do this anymore. Something has to change. And that's pretty much when I contacted you. But I said, this is it. Let me put my focus in this. And for me, my focus was, let me do the bits and pieces whenever I have the space to do it, which is not much, but I will tell you that 15 minutes on LinkedIn, looking at three or four job descriptions every couple of days was really helpful to do those gut checks. It wasn't an 8 hour a day sitting there with, you know, this fabulous cup of coffee and no. It was really like, okay, I have some time. This is the thing that I want more than anything. I want to get out of academia. I want to get into industry. Like, let me do all of the small acts that I can in order to get to that larger thing. So I would say that it was doing it in small pieces, which I think was incredibly helpful with you, because it was every week. It was bite-sized, it was manageable, and it was like, this is what we're doing. And so I also had, over the time that you and I worked together, I was also able to get that sense of working towards a goal. So even if the rest of my day and the rest of my week, I wasn't able to focus on it, it was like, okay, but at the end of 8 weeks, I've put in 8 weeks of, you know, consistent work towards this. And it did it.
It did. And baby steps, being persistent, following your intuition. Yeah. Taking even just like a few moments of introspection every day, perusing LinkedIn, asking for help, and then just taking your time and taking baby steps. And you did it. And you did very well.
I did.
Phenomenally well.
and I think too, you know, I don't want people to feel like you have to, and actually I would not recommend, you know, going down the LinkedIn rabbit hole. I think it's actually really smart to do it in timed segments, because you can get stuck there and it can kind of fester and be its own force. So set an alarm, 20 minutes, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to spend 10 minutes looking at job descriptions and then 10 minutes looking at people who have similar roles in those job descriptions and get back out.
Thanks for listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, the podcast for people who research people. I'm Imani, the host and creator. Visit yizzyresearch.com for podcast show notes and information about my UX research coaching program. Again, that's yizzyresearch.com, YZZI research.com. This podcast was produced by Whisper and Mutter.